This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
In the Odyssey, in addition to all the mortal dangers that Odysseus and his crew face in their attempt to get back home from the Trojan War, in addition to having to escape monsters like the Cyclops, they are confronted with a different kind of danger, that of the land of the lotus eaters, where they're tempted to be lulled into a narcotized, blissful stupor, or by Circe, a witch who turns Odysseus's crew into swine. And finally, by the goddess Calypso, who offers Odysseus the chance to be her lover and stay with her on her island forever and become immortal. All of these, in their own way, are dangers to be overcome on the journey home. Although given the fact that all of Odysseus's crew perishes on the journey, it's not entirely clear that he did them any favors by rescuing them from either the land of the lotus eaters or from Circe. But Odysseus himself has to renounce the opportunity to live like a god in order to fulfill his human destiny. And the implication is that there are virtues that are only realizable as a human being. A god has no need of courage, for instance. Homer presents Achilles and Odysseus as the heroic models of the highest attainment possible in a warrior culture. Although in a kind of unstated way, he, by creating the Iliad and the Odyssey, offers another kind of model of excellence outside that of being a warrior. Each culture has its own notion of what counts as human flourishing, as the highest form of life that we can aspire to. And the definition of higher, the question which way does the arrow of flourishing point, turns out to be non-trivial and quite a matter of conflict and dispute within cultures and certainly from culture to culture. With the advent of Christianity, you go from the model of Achilles, the perfect hero warrior, to the image of the victim, the suffering Christ, as the highest form of attainment we can aim for. And while the image of Christ allows for the valorization of human suffering in a way that picture of Achilles or Odysseus does not, it also introduces the idea that there's something higher than the body, separate from the body in a spiritual realm that we attain to, and why we are not simply victimized by our suffering body. As the whole Christian notion of contemplation, spirituality developed, it's hard not to see it as a ongoing denigration of the body as the locus of desire and sexuality and vulnerability, and the cultivation of something higher and spiritual that is going to be free from bodily constraint and contaminant. When you look at the temptations in the Odyssey, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with bodily pleasure or sexuality or appetite. They are temptations because we can be marooned there on our way towards something higher. But in themselves, they're not bad. They become a problem precisely because they're good. We want them. And the way we're challenged is to see that there are a hierarchy of goods, and that we must climb the ladder of goods if we want to reach a pinnacle of flourishing. In the Christian West, though, we get a unfortunate tendency to treat the body, and particularly sexuality, as no longer a good in itself, but the very mechanism and sign of our fallen nature. And one of the ways to understand the rise of monasticism and the creation of the monk as the ideal human being is to see we've come to a model of asceticism, denial of the body, the extirpation of sexuality, and the pursuit of something higher as the fulfillment of human potential. It's a very, very far away from Odysseus. And it's unfortunately a corollary of what is called spirituality, both Christian and in Buddhism, that chastity is considered the sine qua non of spiritual practice. That one way or another, we create a hierarchy of values in which spirituality and sexuality or sensuality and emotional attachment are considered not just one higher than the other, but one being an absolute negation of the other. Now, it was an interesting move in the time of the Reformation, that there was a conscious repudiation of the monastic ideal in favor of the idea that Christianity could be fully and best expressed in ordinary life. That the Christian virtues of love and charity are fully available to people in the world, and that there was a revolt against the ideal of monasticism as being quintessentially Christian. And we can see an interesting parallel taking place now in American Buddhism, where again there is a emphasis on the idea that the Dharma can be fully realized, expressed, and transmitted in lay life. Now, the problem that occurred in the Reformation when the monastic ideal was overthrown is that you could say all the asceticism and hatred of body and pleasure was suddenly released from the monastery and let loose on the world. So that you could say what the Catholics had the good sense to confine to the monastery suddenly was let loose in the form of Puritanism and Calvinism. And now nobody was allowed to have a good time. you know, suddenly the highest forms of Christianity were available to everybody, but again, highest was automatically seen as in opposition to temporal and bodily pleasure. There's something in us that inevitably seems to take that route. Once in a blue moon, you get an interesting Christian heretic like William Blake, you know, who comes out of a weird little dissenting sect, the Muggletonians, who is able to revel in the body as a source of both delight and spirituality. But he is notable for being such an exception. In any case, to continue this magical mystery tour a little closer up to the present, so much of the healing of what we take for granted of the restoration of the body is pretty much a result of Romanticism. There is a two-pronged attack that takes place in the 18th century, where the Enlightenment, by promoting reason over faith, undermines the influence of the church and the values that go with it. And at the same time, you have the romantic and revolutionary movements that seek to restore value to emotion and to attachment and to the body and sexuality. Mostly we take that for granted, although the notion of what counts as higher is still problematic as soon as we enter any kind of religious practice, east or west. What happens as a result of the trend of the rest of the Reformation and of Romanticism in the reclamation of ordinary life, the return of spirituality via immanence to our daily practice rather than a pursuit of transcendence through something like monasticism, is that we end up with a tension within our culture and our practice between this newly validated ordinary life and the question of what it is exactly we're supposed to aspire to. We can say that it was a great triumph to replace transcendence with immanence, to revalorize, re-legitimize the body and the ordinary. But where is our practice going? Which way is up now? Right. Nietzsche claimed that we had been so democratized and Christianized and feminized that we have completely lost sight of the heroic. And that we had no way back to that sense of what a real man should aspire to, right? And in our Zen practice, we are still torn between aspirations to the heroic and aspirations to being more fully ordinary, whatever that's supposed to look like. Zen, of course, has a long foregrounded tradition of the heroic, and that the highest accomplishments available to us still are going to occur through monasticism, through extraordinary feats of asceticism, self-denial, or heroic measures and bouts of meditation, that this is the one real path of enlightenment. This is sort of the Rinzai Achilles method of Zen, right? And yet there's another balancing path that asks us to see practice realized here and now, just sitting, Joko, very much trying to get practice back down into everyday life and say, don't kid yourself, the heroics may be very exciting, but what you do in your daily life is what practice is really about. Very different kind of picture of what to aspire to. See, I've gone all the way through all these different things because I think the question of what do we aspire to is very crucial in our practice. A lot of what I've written about over the years is how aspiration can go awry in the form of a secret practice. Yet I don't know that we should take that to mean that aspiration in itself is inevitably neurotic or something to be done away with. But we have to be clear what we're aiming for and why. It may be that what we have to decide is which is rarer. Which is the rarer accomplishment, to be the hero or to genuinely be ordinary?